what's up, guys? Welcome to Garage Media Junkies, episode 47. If you think about it, if you've been listening for a long time, which I kind of don't believe, listen to this crap all the time, but it's almost 50, and it's a couple of weeks ago, it was Chris and I anniversary. I know, our wives are so jealous. 1 year together, which we didn't thought about it. Anyways, today is a really special event, to call it. You know that we have guests every once in a while, and I always try to pursue or, you know, bring people that works on the business of media in some sort of ways. You know, with our phones, we have so much media all the time that's nuts to think about it. But anyways, I'm going to let my guest to introduce herself to the audience, please.
Hello, my name is Christina Ree, and I am thrilled to be here.
Thank you. So, you know, just to explain you a little bit of what the dynamic that goes to the podcast focus in media, anyways, pretty much just everything that we consume through a screen. I mean, an app can be considered a media or even an art form, you know, to do it. So my first question will be, how was your relationship with media when you were young, you know, from 5 to 10 years old? How was the dynamic in your house towards media? Because in my case, and we discuss this with Chris all the time, we're the opposites. My parents never have that much limits, but he was like, no, you just have like 1 hour of TV and that's it.
Well, I'm actually kind of old. So there wasn't, the only screen was the TV, and that happened when I was a kid, not since I was born.
Right, right.
And it was a little black and white screen and nothing that interesting on there. But as I got older, we had one of those enormous pieces of furniture that was actually a TV.
Yes, I remember those.
Yeah, and I think my parents really wanted me to watch TV because they're immigrants and they really wanted me to learn English.
Gotcha.
So Sesame Street was like encouraged. So every night we'd be watching TV, Love Boat, Sesame Street, that kind of thing.
It's funny because I always tell them, but my parents make me audition for Sesame Street when I was a little baby. Oh. I'm so glad I never did it because my mom is really like, she will be like my little star, you know, will like exploit me or something. Sorry, Mom, but that's your dark secret. So what was like something that sort of caught your attention? Those days? Like maybe a show, well, you say Sesame Street was like a little bit the most interesting part. But
so so my parents were Korean. They didn't speak English.
Yeah.
And I grew up in a very non-Asian neighborhood. I grew up in Oakland.
Okay.
I was born and raised in a pretty...
Raiders.
Yes. A pretty mixed neighborhood. It was mostly black professionals. And then my parents. And then it was a neighborhood where I think a lot of white residents had actually abandoned it. Not abandoned, but there it was like the white flight thing.
Gotcha.
So I was always trying to decode American society
because
my parents had no roadmap to guide me, and I felt like the families I saw on TV were the script I was somehow supposed to study and learn. So I remember in particular I'd see episodes about Christmas, and we didn't do Christmas, and I would study what you were supposed to do and how many gifts you're supposed to get and what this thing with the stockings were and how full they were supposed to be. So if we ever did do Christmas, I couldn't just put one thing. It had to look full, you know? So that was kind of my relationship to TV when I was younger, right?
It's so interesting you mentioned that because in a way I feel like I'm in this kind of hybrid thing because I'm from TJ. And in a way, I never feel related to my relatives in the South a little bit. I would feel like I will come to San Diego and like, oh, yeah, this kind of, it's already a part of us. So it's so interesting that you mentioned that that was your focus. Because for a long time, I mean, you know, America's always been like, you know, putting a little bit of like the first, how can put it, you know, on society, it's sort of like they spend culturally and especially with media.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the Coca-Cola Polar Bear commercials still make me like super sensitive and it's like, damn you, Coke, damn you.
You're tearing up, Hugo. I see it in your eyes.
This is just that part, you know, like it's, even though I'm really interested in knowing other, you know, cultures and people, you never notice it, like how hard it is for somebody come from outside and establish in a country that maybe don't care really that much.
I mean, I felt acutely aware of not fitting in.
Right.
Because I was always reminded wherever I went, you know. Yeah. It was, there was a lot of racist jokes that kids would do. And then, you know, even in the school system, the teacher would ask me what it was like for Chinese New Year. And I'm like, I'm not Chinese.
Right, right. And get your info right, girl.
Yeah. And so I was desperately trying to figure out how to behave in order to, you know, to fit in.
Right. How was, you know, sort of going to your teens?
Media?
Yes.
Okay, so...
Probably you start having, you know, more exposure to other things.
Yeah, so back then still, it was you see a movie in the theaters.
Right.
Maybe you'd have a VHS player. But Revenge of the Nerds had a big impact.
Interesting.
In the teen years. A lot of hip-hop and R&B. And I think this is when I started to really appreciate black music, especially in Oakland, and nerd culture. And there was no smartphones or anything like that.
Right.
TV still sucked, to tell you the honest truth. So it was all about the movies and the music in the 80s.
Any like particular, like you already say that movie, but anything impactful? You know, because we always talk that... sort of that age, teenaging, you know, growing up, finally coming of age. There's always like a movie or something that's either sexually or violent that impact you so much. Because, you know, the grown-ups always kind of try to cope that or cover. Like, no, I don't get exposed to that.
Well, the first movie that I saw in a theater was Annie Hall. My dad took me to the Woody Allen movie, I think in the late 70s.
Yeah.
And I remember seeing, I don't remember the movie, but I remember seeing Diane Keaton in bra and underwear. And that,
that was
my mom was really pissed that he took me. And that sort of excited me.
Yeah.
And then I think in teenage years, Blade Runner had a really big impact on me because it was so gothic.
It's still like
beautiful.
I saw it and like I need to see it a couple more times. Every time it's a different thing.
Right. And it I think it was my first introduction to science fiction films that didn't feel schlocky.
Yeah.
And that had such psychological complexity and, you know, and then it had an alternate ending, and I was really taken into that world.
Well, I mean, kind of we're going that way a little bit.
Yeah.
I mean, we have now the Echo that talks to you and listen to you all the time.
Right.
Steal all your info.
And you know what else? Music videos were really, really
They were
amazing.
Really, they were dope.
They were just starting to come out, and it was a whole new format that you couldn't stop looking.
Yeah.
And a song suddenly became really visual. I loved it.
Yeah, I feel like, I mean, now it's hard for music industry to pull, like, put that much money.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the one that kind of remembers Michael Jackson, it was the first video I saw, like, oh, like, it's so much. I bet there were a couple millions invested in that, for sure.
Mm-hmm.
But you don't see that much, besides the big artists, but, you know.
Yeah.
And also it was, like, the aperture for directors. Like, now it's all restrained, and, like, this is what you need to do. And it was more experimental at that point.
Yeah.
Probably that was the appealing of...
I think it was just this beautiful combination of a very short runtime.
Yeah.
With no goal except to illustrate the music.
Exactly.
So it could be narrative or it could just be conceptual or it could be completely just a mood. It could be like poetry, like a fragment.
Right.
And so that was really fun to see the different kinds of styles.
Sweet. Yeah, I like what was, 70s-ish, 80s kind of?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that was like...
I think it was
like
84 when MTV first...
Yeah, when
unleashed.
MTV was cool, I guess.
And their first video was Video Killed the Music Star? Or I can't remember anymore.
No, I don't remember.
Video Killed the Movie Star? I can't remember. I just sang for you.
I wasn't born yet.
Oh!
I'm from 87, so...
That's great.
But still, like, I think
I
reach... You're fine. What was... I mean, you're an artist because remember, guys, I talked to my teacher a couple podcasts ago. Well, this is it. And we mentioned you guys that was the first impression. It was a powerful, impactful. And I mean, the thing is, I always have a problem with the word artist kind of before. I'm getting used to it to use it. But I'm pretty sure that there are so much factors why I feel that the word artist, you know, have a conflict with the word. But the fact that you came just straight and like, you know, that's who I am. That was great. So what was in your teens? What was like you started noticing that that was kind of like the thing you want to do?
Ooh, I had a really long path towards saying I am an artist.
Yeah.
And
I'm glad. I don't feel like I'm the only one.
I think I only started a week ago. Yeah. No, so I went to school and never thought of it, but I was always involved in creative stuff. I made my own dark room.
Yeah.
You know, I found a 35 millimeter and would just take pictures and learn how to process them on my own.
Right.
And this was before digital photography. And then in college, I actually studied economics. And it was kind of a fancy college. It was really expensive. My parents, you know, I felt a lot of pressure to make money.
Yes.
and I graduated and got kind of a corporate job and quit after about a year and a half and went into public health and community justice kind of stuff in Oakland, and then quit that and then started working in an art center. And all along I was still enrolling in photography classes, doing creative projects with other artists, doing performances, so anyone around me would know that actually I'm going to diagnose you. That's what you want to be. Yeah. But I myself wasn't ready to say it. And it is a scary thing to say.
Yeah.
Because when somebody says, I'm an artist, the next question is, oh, what do you do?
Right.
And it's really hard if you're not a painter or an illustrator
to show
what you do and explain what you do coherently. I think a lot of artists I know are not that cohesive or coherent in order to say, I do this, right?
Yeah.
And I'm definitely the kind of person that I do anything but painting and drawing.
Yeah.
So it's hard sometimes to define myself that way. So a recent art project I did in Korea was actually we went into a public market and we bought and sold Lucky Dreams for money that we invented. Yeah. Now, how do you explain that as art to someone who thinks art is like a Monet or, you know?
It's kind of like that fine line sometimes. Mm-hmm. And like you say, society sort of help us to put art in these certain you know, scenarios, and that's it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Like, anything else far beyond the... I mean, first of all, I don't know for you, but for me, I already... My mind, it's a chaos. And that's the reason I use sort of like these artistic disciplines to try to translate them. But if for us, it's really hard to translate them, then for people to understand them, it's even harder.
I think one of the awesome things about art is also the reason it's so hard to say you're an artist.
Yeah.
And that is that no one really understands what that is.
Right.
So the great thing about that is you can use, I am an artist, that phrase, you can use that as armor. So you could go do somewhat illegal things.
Right.
And if the police stop you, say, oh, officer, I'm an artist.
Yeah.
And they don't know how to digest you.
Right.
And that's great. But I think for the very same reason, it's confusing for someone like us to say, I'm an artist, but I don't know what that is.
What exactly? Yeah, but that's what I kind of discuss all the time. You know, you graduate, let's say, and I'm not diminishing anything or like one side or the other, but let's say you graduate some related medicine, you sort of have a pattern that you follow, and it's kind of like there. You know, you try to find a job, you keep scaling, but when you try to do an artist discipline, it's not really a walk road that you follow, and that's it. It's always really hard, and I think it's always doubtful. You have those times where you have so much doubts, and then, oh no, I have everything. It's fine right now.
Yeah.
So it's like
you know, like
down.
Some people say they're a writer.
Yeah.
But maybe they haven't written a book in 3 years. I think that they set a similar sort of
approach. Yeah.
Insecurity, too. Yeah. But anyway, so.
See, I told you, like, we always go off topic.
Yeah.
But it's fine. It's
fine. No, so I graduated, I did all these things, and then I worked in an art center. It's actually the largest art center for people with disabilities, and it's considered outsider art. But it's not patronizing, it's not charity. It's actually, you know, we would have exhibitions, we would get our artists collected by museums. I did all the marketing and the fundraising and the gallery preparation. And
That's a lot of
some of the curation. But it was thrilling. And then I had a kid. And I realized, because I suddenly had this alien creature that was so demanding of me, that I had to figure out how to be selfish for myself real quick before the alien creature took over my life. So I decided while I was breastfeeding, I need to go to art school. Yeah. It's always been something I toyed with and was afraid to look in the eye, but I need to go do it. So I applied and then I got in.
Nice.
And after that, I felt, I still wasn't saying I'm an artist. And I said, you know what? Why did I go to school if I can't even say I'm an artist? I have to just say it. And so that's kind of
get
where
get used
that came
to
from.
It, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah, because really, I mean, it's a complex term, but mm-hmm. but also it's like really human and, you know, like it's just, I guess, something that it's almost like a pastor, almost like a coming of age ritual, I guess. Mm-hmm. That's how I see it. You grow as a person emotionally and, you know, what you try to do. And, you know, to a certain point, you feel comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like, I mean, there's nothing wrong. It's just, I guess it resonates a lot with me because I've been battling a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And you kind of give me that push to, like, maybe feel comfortable.
You are an artist.
Which I appreciate. Yeah, my wife's like, it's fine, you know, like, you just say it and then that's it.
Yeah.
You become that.
It's true. It is scary, but it's true.
Yeah.
And I will diagnose you. You have the mental illness called
there
artist.
You go, artist. Thank you. Now I'm officially graduated.
Yes.
So you were born here in the U.S.?
I was born in Oakland, yeah.
Oakland, right. California. Sorry. My bad.
No, it's U.S., yeah.
So you mentioned already a little bit of, you know, the complexity of coming from a, you know, family from outside of the country.
Mm-hmm.
How do you think that heritage influenced your work? Especially now. I would like to say now, but then we have a guy that's in the White House that kind of put us back in time.
Yeah.
But, you know, at least on society, you know, we're opening to all sort of cultures and absorbing and, you know, mixing.
Yeah. I think being from a transnational background is really, really complicated, especially if your skin is marked. And by that, I mean people see you and they always wonder where you're from.
Mm-hmm.
So you never quite escape that. And then, you know, that's a commonly talked about, like, you know, you can be born in the U.S. and they think you're a foreigner, but then you go back to whatever, the motherlands, and they think you don't belong.
Right.
And so that is something I was pretty okay with, even though it's actually very complicated and interesting.
Yeah.
But I think it did give me this sensation of being outside looking in and floating and kind of trying to understand these systems of belonging and what that means. I think in the end I decided belonging is really a fantasy to begin with.
Yeah.
It's not the right measure of existence because there is no safety in the world. There is no really knowing anyone in the world. But I think things have always interested me around language and how people misrecognize or mistranslate things, and I think those slippery things are very fun for me.
Yeah.
So I did do projects where a psychic gives a reading in one language and it's translated into another language, and then sometimes use that translation to make artwork. And so it's really going through three different languages. And then I've also been, you know, kind of curious about, like, what is the relationship of being international mean? So I did a residency in Korea with a good friend of mine who's Filipina-American. Her name is Rianne Estrada. And we were invited as international artists. But in Korea, being Filipino means there's like an association of being labor class.
Yeah.
And being Korean-American has association of being, you know, a sellout or not pure or, you know, other things. And so, and then we were also asked to make projects that talk about the small rural towns and so that's a really interesting dynamic.
Yeah.
And I think because I grew up with my background, it helps me navigate those kinds of things where, you know, this idea of international and who's the expert and who's the local, who's regional are all ideas that I think I play with.
Yeah, it resonates a little bit with me, your background. Mm-hmm. I mean, even though I was born in Mexico, the fact that I was in the border, it's a different dynamic. And I have a hate-love relationship with America a lot. I mean, if you go more to the south, it's like freaking, you know, gringos or whatever.
Yeah.
They hate them. They hate them because it's a geopolitical kind of thing going on between the border, especially that border. It's insane. Mm-hmm. If you're going, you know, across to U.S. from Mexico, be patient. Mm-hmm. It can take a long time. Mm-hmm. But anyways, coming back to that, it's like in Mexico, we have this almost kind of feeling of, you know, I guess because the background of the country, that's our proudest thing we can say. Like, oh, we're the cool guys with mm-hmm. the hats and the tequila. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I feel like it's not a negative impact, but kind of like on a cultural level, just leave the people sitting there without exploring other ways mm-hmm. or, you know, saying, you know, more than that is just tequila and stuff. Mm-hmm. So I really, I kind of understand, you know, that thing that you're saying about going to other country, like who's the expert and, you know, what's the measure or the value of who decides
right.
what is right and wrong.
I mean, I think what's really great about our times now is that, like, people of color are getting more opportunities to represent different stories. Mm-hmm. Still not great yeah. amounts, but especially, like, young people, because of internet, online YouTube platforms and Instagram, there yeah. is really much less centralization over who you get right. to choose to listen to.
Yes.
And I feel really excited by that. So when I was growing up, it was impossible to see a yeah. non-white TV show or film.
Yeah.
And if you saw Asians in the film, they're always the punchline, they're made fun of. So I was pretty mortified. But now in 2017, people are flocking to Asian cinema. They love K-pop. All these non-Koreans watch yeah. Korean drama. They're yeah. more experts at it than I am. All the black TV shows right now are amazing. They just thrill me because it's just, yes, we need all these different
Yeah, they're finally
stories.
Coming to the center mm-hmm. instead of, you know, being in the back and
right.
do your thing and get out of here
right.
kind of thing. So, yeah, it's fun that you talk about Asian, especially Asian cinema. I mean, it wasn't that much back in the day. Same thing, no internet, so it was hard. And you have whatever, you know, Hollywood throw you. Mm-hmm. But now I'm slowly going to that, and it's really amazing what they can do. Like mm-hmm. the drama, like, because normally even in the Oscars, it's like international. It's like, yeah, whatever. It's gonna be the drama, but like this cultural problem, blah blah blah. Let's give them the Oscar and, you know, get out. But now they're doing like action movies. They're taking all the things that kind of fall in love with Hollywood and appropriate them and like mix it up, and here's my, you know, my new cake, my new take. Mm-hmm. Just go and eat it
yeah.
and enjoy it. Enjoy it a lot, you know, the frosting is better or something like that. But yeah, I'm being amazed. I mean, there a few I can name right now. The last one that I saw, I think it was Train to Busan. Mm-hmm. And I love the take on the zombies. Mm-hmm. You know, and this confined place. It's just these fresh ideas that are coming out.
Yeah.
And you know, I was another thing that was funny that I find here, especially also with my wife, she don't likes to read subtitles. We're used to, mm-hmm. right? But it was like somebody tried to put it in English. And like, no, just leave it in that language.
Oh, you mean dub it?
Yeah.
Yes.
And like, no, don't do that. Just leave it in the language, because it breaks the, not the illusion, but, you know, like, doesn't have the same sense at all.
Yeah, I think studios have, a lot of dumb studios have the dumb idea that it makes it more accessible. But it actually turns off a huge yeah. proportion of the audience who actually understand even the sound of the language yeah. is important. And it doesn't have to be native speakers in those languages.
Right.
So when people dub, for example, Bruce Lee films, people get really pissed off.
Yeah, because he sounds dumb,
mm-hmm,
you know, the way right. he's delivering the line. Like, no, it doesn't match the emotional, you know, perform
yeah.
with the way it's delivering the lines
yeah.
at all. Same with anime. I'm a big fan of anime and
oh,
I always
cool.
watch it in, you know, in their nature, like their tongue, like the mm-hmm. original tongue. And it's like, why is he like that? Well, because I feel like that's the real, you know, message, the
yeah.
emotion. And also with the language. I mean, I'm pretty sure the Japanese intonation changed to, you know, Chinese or mm-hmm. Korean. You know, they have the singularities, and
mm-hmm.
that's part of the charm of all this.
Yeah, I feel like it's a whole body experience. And when you take out the sound and replace it with really clunky, the worst actors you could find,
yeah,
we hear it, and all we can imagine is some schmuck in a studio.
Yeah, it's like a cheap-ass studio, and like in some alley, dark alley.
Yeah.
You know, we're going to pay you cheap. Just say the lines. I can do that.
Right. You do a better job.
I will try. Yeah. For sure. How you think is the, especially the Korean culture, but I think you say it, you mentioned K-pop.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the films are really great. So they're sort of influencing part of the, you know, the whole culture, the global culture.
Yeah. So I do also work at the San Diego Asian Film Festival as a programmer. And yeah. So what that means is every year we screen, I don't know.
Not I
know
a lot of movies.
A lot of yeah. movies, and we meet and we discuss them, we argue over them, we decide yeah. which ones will be in the festival, and then we write about them, we meet the filmmakers and do Q&As. And the exciting thing is you get a real slice of what's going on now, because we only show films that are this year and maybe the year before.
Oh, okay, so it's really fresh.
Yeah, very fresh. It's either world premiere, U.S. premiere, something that's been on some of the festival circuits,
yeah.
Or discoveries. And you really kind of see maybe the themes that are happening,
right?
Kind of the new voices or what the masters are doing. And what's been happening since, I think, early 2000 is a lot of the Korean cinema is now being adapted by Hollywood, lots yes. of times disastrously. I won't name names, but My well, Sassy Girl to, comes
train,
to mind.
Train to Busan, they're going to remake it.
Yeah.
And like, why you need to do it? Just let it be.
Right.
Just.
And so I think that's just a commercial move
yeah.
To kind of exploit good narrative and good content. But when you read interviews with a lot of filmmakers in America, a lot of them are very well versed in international cinema, and so I think that's really great. I just have a problem with them not citing their sources because there are some filmmakers that pretend like they were never influenced by international yeah. cinema, that they somehow came up with
yeah,
a lot
these
of
amazing
themselves.
Idea, yeah.
Right. And so a really famous example is Martin Scorsese's take on Infernal Affairs, which I forget how it was, the retitle. That's a pretty famous Hong Kong movie, but he reshot it in Boston with Matt Damon and Mark Wahlberg. And
The Departed. Yeah, I know about that.
And in his acceptance speech, he sort of dismissed the source. He said, oh, it's a Japanese film, which is not. It's a Hong Kong film.
Yeah.
And more than that, like, he incorporated scenes in his own film that were sort of racist, like against Asians, in a way that made me feel like he has some issues with the fact, he has personal issues or anxieties with the fact that he's interpreting an Asian film, because that was a little over and beyond. And, you know, I do feel like these movies are texts. They're sort of things that you can diagnose, you can study the maker. And it made me realize he doesn't really want to have been influenced by that film. He can't even cite it properly.
Yeah.
But if it had been like a French film, he would have been really proud to sing it off the mountaintops.
That's interesting you bring it. And now I'm just like putting dots together, because I kind of know it, but I never put a lot of attention.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, like, we can go beyond that and back even on time. He's a son from Italian immigrants. And it was a time in New York with all these like little, we can call it sort of colonies around the neighborhood. You know, we have the Little Italy. We have, you know, the Chinese, what's called that little, I forget the name. It has a name, but I forget. Mm-hmm. So sad. But, you know, like, at some point they were kind of almost like, not rivals, but, you know, they're these core big little groups of people. So I wonder if that's something to do. Like, it has adds so much layers to what you say right now.
Yeah.
And I really agree on that. Normally in Hollywood, they, you know, I mean, we can say that they were whoever, like, that invent cinema, I guess, as the way we know it. But it's a tendency to, like, now this is my biggest idea, and I did it, and it's mine, and nobody else, and we're the rulers. And I think that's even the biggest problem in Hollywood right now, the industry. They don't know how to tackle that. Like, it really taken by surprise. Now we have a Netflix where they're giving money to all these creators to do what they want to do, not what they're told to do. I don't know if you agree with me.
Can you summarize in a different way?
I mean, basically, it's coming back to what you say about not giving the proper recognition to the people, in especially in international film, and now Hollywood is having a trouble to understand what's going on that side. You know, we have all this Asian amazing filmmaking, also Mexican filmmaking is coming all over the place, bringing new ideas, and Hollywood doesn't have control of that.
Yeah, I think they are very consciously trying to make the money off of those films by making their own versions of it. I think that's totally a business move, and it's sort of like they're doing cheap knockoffs of these imported goods, and they don't, you can tell when they remake them, they just, there's no real respect for the original. It really is to make sure that the original doesn't get too much of the market share. So Korea's had a long, like, difficult relationship with Hollywood. Hollywood, actually, the U.S. government, in their trade negotiations with Korea, forced Korean movie theaters to show over 50% of their screens to show Hollywood films. So Hollywood and the U.S. government help each other to have global domination, and in the process they squeeze out opportunities for small filmmakers to get their movie shown. Well, what happened is Korean government decided to push back and they changed that quota, and then they also started to fund a lot of filmmakers, so they had a really robust government subsidized filmmaking program. And that's why we saw so much amazing cinema in the late 90s, early 2000s, from Korea, that then went on to influence other filmmakers. But I think that Hollywood is like a government. It is like a corporation.
More like a ruler, almost. Yes. You know? It's like, no, this is what we're going to do.
They think in terms, I mean, there's no they, but there are people in power that are thinking in terms of dominating screens. And that means crowding out other voices. Right. So Korean's government was criticized for protecting their theaters, their movie theaters, and their filmmakers. And the U.S. critics were saying, oh, well, you're protectionist. Yeah. And the truth is Hollywood was entirely protectionist of their own global distribution. So, I think they have a problem because of people have more access to other stories. Yeah. But they are still able to... they're still able to kind of silence a lot of them.
Yeah.
But I do feel like we're in an interesting time where a lot of viral protesting and representation politics are making Hollywood forced to pretend to be a little bit more aware.
I mean,
I'm not going to say they are more aware or that they care, but they're
going to care until they start losing a lot of money, which they're kind of losing money.
Yeah.
Like, you have a service like Netflix, they punch them in the face, like, I'm gonna do my own productions. They're investing so much money.
Yeah, that's pretty exciting. I loved seeing that Amazon and Netflix were making movies that were in theaters, and it wasn't just the big familiar studios.
Right, it was a whole change when they started giving awards to those productions.
But I would argue that Amazon and Netflix are still making Hollywood-style films.
Oh, yeah. I mean,
they're Hollywood-style independent films.
Yeah.
But they're still largely, pretty heterosexual white storylines, right?
Yeah. It will take a longer time. But, at least I like that here and there, they like a squeeze, like, okay, this is, watch this foreign great movie, and give him the credit, put him in the spotlight. But again, it's an American company, so of course they're gonna keep that line sort of. How was the sort of adventure that you have going to photography, because that's one of your, I mean, you mentioned that you do a lot of art, different art, but just because I'm in your class, I'm intrigued about when definitely photography clicked for you.
I think photography clicked for me through teaching the class. Yeah. Photography's always been a part of my art practice.
Yeah.
And I've always used it, and I think much of the work that artists do end up as photographs, whether it's documentation or an ingredient. And so photography is very much a part of my work. And I think about things in terms of how they will look eventually as a photograph. Yeah. So even though I'm doing, let's say, a social performance, I have to keep always in mind, is this the right perspective, where I would put the documentary camera in order to catch the best performance documentation. So, but I think because teaching is a way of really making you think through a field, I've gotten a chance to really, really, really strengthen or expand or really appreciate the field in a different way. The thing I love about photography for me is that it's an object, but it's also a performance. And what I mean by that is visual images perform in society. They do things to what we think is real or not real. They do things in terms of making us think about who is the subject in that picture? Are they being objectified? Mm-hmm. Are they defying or refusing society's beliefs? Because so much of the representation that's historical are the things that we bring to looking at a picture. And so a picture performs by looking back and saying something different. And so that's when it all clicked for me.
Right. And also, I mean, it changed. The funny thing is everybody thinks that freeze on time, but actually the meaning changed depending on the era.
Right.
For sure.
Yeah. And it's really exciting now because all the students are so familiar with image making.
Yeah.
They feel very comfortable taking a picture. And they feel very much like I'm allowed and entitled to take a picture.
Right.
Whereas before the smartphones, people felt like you had to master the gadget. You had to be a technical expert.
Technician.
In order to say you're a photographer. So I love that now everyone feels like a photographer. And that's the way it should be.
Yeah, and I'm like you say, I still feel like I'm that gap generation, like the transition generation a little bit. Where, yeah, photographer was a technician where, you know, it was like almost like a secret society that nobody knew.
Mm-hmm.
And we're not going to share our secrets. And now that we have this aperture, I mean, as much I take the class, also, like, you can go online and really find some great information.
Yeah, I always say, you know, I'm not here to be the expert source of information. I'm holding a space for you to allow yourself to learn. Because... Yes. Learning to learn is actually the hardest part. It's not the grade, it's not how you do on a test, but teaching your body how to learn and enjoying it is actually the hardest part. So you could easily teach yourself everything you wanted to learn online, Google searches.
Yeah.
But actually having a space where you're committing to it and you go twice a week is really different. And that's like, you know, I always talk about going to the gym. I don't like to exercise. I would never do sit-ups and push-ups. But if I had paid to have a physical trainer meet me twice a week and make me do it, that's sort of what my class is, right?
Yeah, and because it's almost like I found it therapeutic for me. And that's my personal experience, your class. And also, it's about really about me, you know, like knowing myself, going through this process.
Mm-hmm.
Either you being one called yourself a photographer, an artist, but and it's really, really hard to find, you know, teachers that allowed you to do that.
Mm-hmm.
At least, again, from my personal experience.
Well, I'm grateful this class is 17, 18 weeks because I know, for example, at UC San Diego, it's 10 weeks.
Yeah.
And so we really have a lot of time for us to get to know each other,
and
figure out what you care about, what I'm like. And then also fail and succeed and fail and succeed over and over again until something starts to happen, right? So the whole range of emotions is what should happen.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you know, I'm not doing anything that different than you could have done yourself, right?
It's almost like it will be almost like a militarized kind of version of it. You know, at least that's how I grew up. Me in school, it always grades, and you need to perform at this level.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, it's an art class, and it's expected to be, you know, this wiggle room of range of emotions that you experience. But all the other teachers, they just make it boring, and like you don't want to be there.
Well, my class is not fun. I mean, I very intentionally say over and over again for the first 2 weeks, don't expect this to be fun. It's actually a lot of work. It's hard.
Right.
It's not fun like people imagine when they say I'm going to sign up for photography. It'll be so fun, right? And I think it's because in order to shift into a new kind of creator, you have to learn or try different things. So if you go to a writing class, you can't just write whatever you want.
Yeah.
The teacher is there to ask you to write a poem, write a recipe, write an essay, write, you know, an argument, write a marketing slogan. You got to try all those different things. And through that process, you start to learn your own creative voice, right?
Yes.
If you're stuck writing song lyrics and you don't want to try anything new, then you really don't need to be in the class. So photography is the same exact way. You're going to try these different things. Some of it's going to be uncomfortable. But eventually, that's why the final project is really important to me, because I want it to be the thing you want it to be.
Right. Right?
And it could be anything. So as you know, we had some students that made photographs into sculptures that you play with your hands.
Yeah, I know. That was like interesting for me, too, being able to like, okay, here's the range of tools that you can use, choose. And, you know, whatever resonates with you, just bring it.
But bring it and really commit to it, right?
Exactly.
So I do. I think that if you have a crazy idea, you know, or a really boring idea, either of those can become great projects if you actually work on it. And you work on it sincerely. And you you take yourself seriously as an artist, you know, because you can have a great idea and try it for a week and decide, I'm over it.
Yeah.
But if you'd actually tried a few more weeks, it might actually become something special.
That's the thing that sort of some people don't understand. You know, we're reminded all the time, like, find a job that you feel passionate in and doesn't feel like work, but the reality is still work.
A lot of work,
work that you need to, you know, put on these projects, especially in art. People think, oh, they're having the fun of their lives. And like, no, I'm frustrated, I'm mad, and then I'm happy. And then, you know, like, I want to just throw everything out of the window, and then you come back. It's a lot of back and forward. It's almost like a battle with yourself.
It really is. And, you know, I just, what's important to me is that students don't leave feeling damaged. Like they feel somehow they leave lesser, you know. It's more important that they leave still feeling like a motor to keep going forward. And that's, I think, really it. It's sort of like if you learn another language, like if I want to learn French or Spanish, you know, I would start with conversational French and just learn some of the words and start to enjoy it and play with it and keep expanding and expanding. And so that sense of play and that sense of kind of a, some fundamentals to get you going, that's really what's important to me.
What's been the hardest part of being a teacher and the greatest?
I hate grading. I see its role, though, but I hate it. And then I do feel very challenged when students check out. And I know part of it has to do with my teaching and my structure. But then the greatest feeling I get is when they really don't check out but actually try it all, and then they get somewhere. And that's the best feeling in the world.
I guess, like, at least they take something out of the class for them.
And when I see how much a student is enjoying their own damn self, that's really awesome.
Well, but you're kind of like that. Like, you're really, I mean, you mentioned they have this structure and it's sort of tough, but just like you infuse it with your like own charm and it's so funny.
Really? I always feel like a robot.
It's like, it's funny. Like, I still remember the chicken analogy with the raw photos. And that was the, you know, instead of being all technical, like, well, it's like a raw chicken, you know? Even somebody right in the Flickr group, like, I was being hungry. But it's fun. I mean, that's, at least that's what I try to find. Even though you say you just have one class, but I can see you're enjoying it. You're having the time of your life, too.
Yeah, it's important to me because I get bored really fast. Once I get bored, it's bad for everyone. And I respect everyone's effort too much. I know that people show up early, they pay their money, they're giving me their time, and I take it pretty seriously. So if I'm bored, I would rather just quit. So I have to keep myself entertained. So I do change. There's certain projects that I change every semester, and there's certain things that we didn't do this semester.
Maybe I need to take it again just to see what's in the other class. How you see the educational, you know, paradigm and for the future, because we mentioned that you could technically go to internet and educate yourself.
Yeah.
same thing. You keep constant like researching, like what can I do to, I guess, justify the day pay and come to your class?
I know that for me, like, it's important that students learn how to learn, like I said. Right. So learn how to study other artists and see the value in studying other photographers. And then it's important to me that I stay excited. So
right.
Whenever I am on the web or going to museums, I try to figure out what excites me and how I can use the class. Sometimes I use the class to try out ideas I've been wanting to do forever. Right. And
we're your little guinea pigs.
Yes, and I think it's okay.
Yeah, that's totally fine.
And I think that's important. So, yeah.
Let's talk a little bit more about your art. How you will describe your process from, you know, being this young person to start, you know, getting interested to now that you even allow yourself to call yourself an artist.
Mm-hmm.
But like, what's the evolution? What's the difference you notice and the constants in your work?
Okay, good question. Well, the constants, I would say, is that there's always been, well, I have always really, really, really thrived in collaboration. So there's different artist groups I've been a part of or worked with.
Yeah.
Or individual artists that I partner with. That's been really important to me. And at first I thought it was like a crutch, but actually I realize it's an important way to do art because you're bigger than just yourself.
Yeah.
And you're doing things more than you could by yourself. And you're also thinking automatically about relationships and how to talk and how to be in the world. As far as themes, one of the running themes has been choosing from everyday materials.
Mm.
So this is very broad. So in graduate school, I did installations that were inspired by Dark Water, which is a Japanese horror film by Hideo Nakata. And I constructed ceilings that were dripping with water. They were live drips. And so people thought they were actually leaking water.
Yeah.
And then in the middle, it collapsed from a lot of water. But I also had a character named Agent O, who would destroy it.
Yeah.
And she was born out of Greek mythology, so she's sort of a combination of Asian immigrant psychics, about the Cyclops myth, and then just my own invention. And so she would go and destroy everything. So there's been sort of running themes of mythology and movies.
Right.
And in Korea, the projects had to do with superstitious practices that everyone has that are really not huge superstitions, but kind of like mistletoe or stepping on a crack. Those are everyday knowledges and everyday practices. And then going to a market, which is a very everyday location.
Yeah.
So things that are accessible and everyday, I think, have been sort of a recurring theme.
Yeah.
Nothing that looks super fancy or expensive. And I don't think it's just because I can't afford it. I think there's a politics to choosing things. It's like punk rock, right? Like,
right. Underground kind of thing.
Yeah.
I lied. I wish I could see that.
Mm-hmm.
Your ceiling idea. I'm intrigued.
Yeah.
Like I'm trying to, you know, make a almost like a picture in my head, but I know it's...
Well, you know those suspended, those drop ceilings that are in every office
and
in every grocery store?
And, just
and they're actually fake ceilings. They hang from wires. So it was like that. And then I installed 5-gallon water tanks behind it that people couldn't see, and they would produce a drip every day. 5 gallons would empty.
Yeah.
And what I noticed was that nobody noticed the stains, and so I also went around town and documented with photography water stains in these ceilings. So they're everywhere, like grocery stores, schools, museums, fancy institutions where you think that ceiling is so solid, but once you see a stain you realize we have a false sense of security, right?
Yeah. Nice. See, people, it's a lot of hard work being an artist.
It's hard work.
A lot. It's like the movies, people, there's the thing in the red carpet. Like, yeah, no, it's not like that. It's actually not. A lot of sweat, run, and bring, like, heavy equipment everywhere.
Yeah. It's the hardest non-paying job there is.
For sure. Trying to figure how to formulate the question. But it's really intriguing that you mentioned, you know, it's always an evolution on the person. So I guess now let's go to the future. I guess we're really what are the, you know, everybody has personal projects, even though we freelancing or whatever to, you know, make an income. It's always those like really almost like a secret projects that you kind of just accumulate them, and at some point they're gonna come, you know. But for you, it's any really particular one that you kind of can't wait to jump in?
My secret project?
Well, not like a secret, but maybe one a side project that you feel like, you know, I want to jump in, even if you don't want to give us details, maybe just like a little.
Well, I mean, right now I've closed down a few, like I've come to sort of the end of a few major things. So it's that really awkward phase where you're sort of nervous because you're not sure if there's anything that's going to fill the vacuum anymore.
Yeah.
I know that I need to get a more stable job with better income.
Yeah.
So that's
the struggle always.
Yeah.
Welcome to our world.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's just staying busy and staying creative. That's always harder than it seems for me.
Oh, yeah.
So that's my project.
Any other discipline that you kind of feel like I kind of want to explore?
Yeah, I love, if I could teach another discipline, I would teach kind of this new genre's hybrid practice kind of class. So that's along the lines of what I do a lot. So it could be interactive installations or where you go out into the public and you kind of interrupt the daily flow. So one of the projects that I've done is called Drive-By Cinema. And we got an old U-Haul truck and we painted it and we would just guerrilla style drive out into the San Diego. We drove out about, I think, 28 times. And we pop up a screen, and we would just use it as a media, experimental media truck. So we would do experimental videos. We do no Hollywood, but always kind of alternative films. We had a cat video night. we once set up a video game tent to see if people want to play. But it was an experiment. We just show up, no permits, and see
what happened.
If we were in a grocery parking lot, what would happen? Would people stop and watch? And at the same time, we'd research the location and we would find out these amazing stories that were layered into that location. And so we'd use the truck to also bring out some of the history that was invisible. So that kind of thing, I think, is a very hybrid practice, very would be fun to do with students.
It definitely will be something to like will push me a little bit out of my comfort zone.
Yes, and I think it would be fun because those kind of projects require you to work with other people.
Yes,
and
it's like a collective of people.
Yeah. So I could see a class doing that really successfully.
Maybe it's in the future.
Yeah, I'm putting it out there.
It reminds me a lot of, I think you told me, you know, Alejandro Jodorowsky. Like, he's known more for his films, but he has amazing books and when he was younger, he will do this kind of, he call it like psychomagic acts. You know, he will go with his friends and let's walk in a straight line until we get tired. And he will walk. If your house was in the middle, he will open a window and cross the house. You know, things like that that some people think it's, you're just wasting your time, but really you're just exploring, you know, your artistic side and your creative side.
Yeah, these are forms of doodling. Right?
Yeah.
And people maybe don't see it as doodling, but once you look at it long enough or see other people that do it, it becomes more and more interesting, right?
Yeah, and I enjoyed it. That kind of sort of activities, artistic activities, I think that I can call them, just because they're awkward, they're intriguing. There's not like a pattern to how you approach that. It's not like you go to a museum, you know, they even a little kid sort of early start learning that you go to the museum, you see the picture.
And you don't touch.
Exactly. And these kind of activities broke all the mold, which, I mean, I enjoy going to a museum, no gaming wrong, but these ones are more rewarding or like my senses like activate so much.
I think this is your next short film.
Maybe. There you go.
It's simple, experimental, and interesting.
Yeah, you need. I'm still writing, but that's the hard part of writing. You get stuck, and then like, what is it? It's kind of like you need to force yourself.
Yeah.
All right. Before we finish, and the podcast, we always ask to the guest give us recommendations. At least I'm always avid to, you know, learn new things, watch new things, feel and sense new things. Mm-hmm. So tell us either, you know, any type of discipline, movies, photography, books, recommendations you feel like you at least should read, watch, or feeling this thing at least once in your life.
Wow, that's a great question. And I know I'm going to answer it and then email you later and say, yeah. Oh, I wish I had said this or this or the other thing.
It's always hard.
So, you know, I love films.
Yeah.
And I can just tell you all maybe a few different things that just excite me. Yeah.
We have time. Don't
worry. I really think that everyone should experience a good K-drama, a Korean drama, because it's a really different format. I think people are used to now the multi-episodic series. Right. Through Netflix, you know, maybe 26 episodes in the end and you have six seasons.
Yeah.
Korean drama is a phenomenon and it's usually about 16 episodes and they're always known for... The interesting thing about this genre is the screenwriters are famous. Yeah. So it's a lot like literature where you actually know who's writing it and you follow that writer to the next drama. Whereas in Hollywood, it's about the director or the actors, right? So, and they're largely women. And so these are really big investments in characters and in story that you don't get in a 2-hour, 3-hour film. And they can be really schmaltzy and overly romantic, but there's a whole range. Some are action. Yeah. They tend to be more mainstream in kind of the format, but they do have some independent experimental ones. The biggest hit from 2017 was Goblin, which is available, I think.
Okay. It's in my brain right now. Yeah. I'm not going to let it go.
And it's, you know, it's like mainstream entertainment, but it's fun.
I'm pretty sure they're better than Mexican soap opera.
No, I don't know. And then I think, you know, reading has, it used to be my friend. I used to always read, and now it's harder and harder to. I can have a book and a phone in my hand and I have the best intentions with a book
and then
I never read it, right?
Yeah.
But I do really value it, and the book, I feel like there was a book that I couldn't put down recently, and Roxane Gay has been a new writer that I've discovered. I think she's kind of pretty well known, and I read her book Untamed State about a woman in Haiti, and now I'm reading short stories by that are called Bad Feminist. Okay. And she's really kind of interesting to read. What else? In terms of movies that are out right now? I don't know. I just love movies.
Doesn't necessarily need to be right now. Like any period of time is fine.
I really love, I love cinema. So I really think everyone should go to the San Diego Asian Film Festival.
Yeah, and I definitely said I couldn't make it this year just because, yeah, I have a little boy.
Mm-hmm.
But the first thing was I wasn't really aware and kind of not bugs me, but I know people that try, you know, put this information out there. It should be on the radar, you know, like it should be more talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
And it kind of like surprised me, like, wait a minute, it's an Asian film festival? Why nobody told me, really? Right.
Yeah, but I mean, it's a somewhat, it's very professional and high caliber programs.
The what's it called, pamphlet or whatever. It was even that, like, so much detail, so much caring, you can tell right away.
Yeah, it is. It's really special. It's a special group of people. They're experts, and everyone, every kind of thing that is put out is like top notch. But we do a showcase that's 1 week long and it's only either one or two screens.
Yeah.
So I think it's about 12 films and that's in either late March or early April.
Right.
But then our regular festival is in November and that's 150 films. And that's, there's just so many great films. So rather than maybe one film, I just say that's just sort of a must do. Yeah.
Just go and have the whole experience.
Yeah.
And don't be lazy. I mean, read subtitles. There's nothing wrong with it. Yeah. My wife is getting better at it. But yeah, she always... And I can tell it's a thing in here. And I just like, subtitles. Like, well, that's, you know, welcome to the third world, bitches. Yeah. That's how we do it all the time, you know. And that's the same thing. Even if I watch an American film, I need to watch an... Even... Especially if I know that film is from, you know, a determined place, I need to listen to the original language because then it doesn't click with me. I know that guy's Japanese. Why you're speaking me in English?
Yeah, there's something just wrong about it. It feels like somebody forced... forced the movie into a zombie state and took over their body and put another person's voice in there. You know what I mean?
Yes.
Like if they had dubbed Pan's Labyrinth in English, they would have just... People would be really disturbed.
I'm pretty sure really bad ADR somewhere about Pan's Labyrinth. I didn't ask you this, but I think it's important before we left... You know, like, especially with my presentation today.
Which was amazing. Thank audience, you. By the way.
Thank you. I will post a few on Instagram. How you think women, it's on the art world right now, what point they are and at which point you wish they were in the future?
Oh, man. So, there's different art worlds.
Yeah.
So, there's the museum gallery art world, which I think most people would say is still very white male world. It's really hard to break in and it's like highly capitalized. So there's photographs going for like $20,000, starting. And so that's a really different atmosphere. And then there's art worlds that are online, and then there are art worlds.
They're amazing. Yeah, yeah. It's so much stuff going on.
And then there are art worlds that exist on campuses and inside classrooms. And I think the challenge is how women maybe have it harder in terms of surviving economically.
Yeah.
And that's across markets, right? But as an artist, it's much harder to make, someone buy your work. I don't really make work that sells like that, so it's
you can
less
figure.
Of a,
you can. Yeah. You have time to figure out.
But I do think it's like infinitely irritating that a white male artist is somehow taken more seriously than a female artist, and it's even more irritating if women artists are expected to make work that's only about women's issues.
Right.
Like that's another form of. Being patronizing.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. I don't know. I can't prognosticate about it.
Yeah.
I don't think it's things get better little by little. And we're not even talking about women of color. So.
Right. Yeah. Somebody tell me something about that. We were discussing about some topic and she was telling me like, yeah, it's a woman. And then it's a, woman of color, that's another degree.
Yeah.
And I think it goes for any race, the structural way of things working still at this point.
Yeah.
It's kind of like that. Well, Christina, you have any social media or anything like that people can find you? Or some of you work, even though if they need to go to a particular place?
I actually, so my artist name is C, first initial C, last name is Ree, R-E-E. I sort of intentionally keep a... distance.
Yeah.
So I don't try to make my footprint that large, but I do have an Instagram feed. It is private.
Yeah. So sorry guys. Not lucky for you.
But I do think I'm supposed to do a professional Instagram feed. So that's good kick in the butt to do it. and then I do have a website for the Korea project, which is everlandland.wordpress.com.
Gotcha.
So everlandland.wordpress.com. Yeah.
And the last thing, any advice for any person out there that have that little bug of being a creative or an artist person?
I think it's really, I totally appreciate the struggle because it's a little voice that won't go away and and it will keep coming out in ways that you can't suppress. So it's sort of like you love the color red and you can't help that you keep buying red. Yeah. You can't ignore it on some level. And so for me, it ended up delaying me for much longer than I should have been delayed. I should have just listened to it a lot sooner. It doesn't mean you'll be successful, but at least you're being more real to yourself. And you deserve to give yourself a chance. So
right. Awesome.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much.
It was a
pleasure. And people, keep coming to us, telling us topics. We can talk about, you know, something that you feel interested in, and we're going to keep trying to bring more guests.
We should interview Hugo, don't you think?
We're planning. I think in the number 50, my buddy Chris sort of challenged me, which is kind of like a asshole move, Chris. But he wanted me to be a little bit drunk, and then we did the podcast. Oh, so maybe we'll do that.
Love that idea.
Yeah, there you go.
Oh, the other thing everyone should listen to, this podcast called TheRead.com.
Okay, The Read.
They frequently do theirs drunk, which is why I thought it
would be. Awesome. Yeah. Perfect. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Hugo.
Have a good day, people. See you in the next one. Peace.